This year marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Dickens, and we're honoring the work of this master of fiction with this special webcast of a Dickens-themed story by another literary master, Evelyn Waugh. I'm here in the studio with our literary commentator, Hannah Tinty, the editor of One Story magazine. Hi, Hannah.
Hi. Evelyn Waugh was an English writer best known for his novel Brideshead Revisited. He's a master of language and great characters. There's this wonderful quote that I have from him. It says, "I regard writing not as an investigation of character, but as an exercise in the use of language, and with this I am obsessed. I have no technical psychological interest. It is drama, speech, and events that interest me."
That's certainly true in the story we're going to hear.
Absolutely. The Man Who Liked Dickens was originally published as a short story and later incorporated into Waugh's novel, A Handful of Dust.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen King has said that The Man Who Liked Dickens was the inspiration behind his best-selling novel, Misery.
Ah.
So The Man Who Liked Dickens takes place in the Amazon and concerns an expedition gone awry. I don't want to spoil the surprising turn of events, but literature, namely the work of Dickens, becomes involved in a life-or-death situation. And because it involves reading, I kept thinking, if I had to choose one book of Charles Dickens to read for the rest of my life, which one would it be? For me, I think it would be Great Expectations. But what about you, Isaiah?
Oh, for me, I think it would be Dombey and Son, because it's such a lovely struggle novel and has such a happy, sweet ending.
See, I just love the characters of Pip and Magwitch, and Joe Gargery makes me cry every time. So that's why I always go back to Great Expectations.
You're just a softie.
I guess I am.
The Man Who Liked Dickens was read by Leonard Nimoy at the Getty Center in Los Angeles.
Although Mr. McMaster had lived in Amazonas for nearly 60 years, no one, except a few families of Shiriana Indians, was aware of his existence. His house stood in a small savanna, one of those little patches of sand and grass that crop up occasionally in that neighborhood, 3 miles or so across, bounded on all sides by forest. The stream which watered it was not marked on any map. It ran through rapids, always dangerous, and at most seasons of the year impassable, to join the upper waters of the river Uraricuera, whose course, though boldly delineated in every school atlas, is still largely conjectural. None of the inhabitants of the district, except Mr. McMaster, had ever heard of the Republic of Colombia, Venezuela, Brazil, or Bolivia, each of whom had at one time or another claimed its possession. Mr. McMaster's house was larger than those of his neighbors, but similar in character. A palm thatch roof, breast-high walls of mud and wattle, and a mud floor. He owned a dozen or so head of puny cattle, which grazed in the savanna, a plantation of cassava, some banana and mango trees, a dog, and unique in the neighborhood, a single-barreled, breech-loading shotgun. The few commodities which he employed from the outside world came to him through a long succession of traders passed from hand to hand in one of the longest threads in the web of commerce that spreads from Manaus into the remote fastness of the forest. One day, while Mr. McMaster was engaged in filling some cartridges, a Shiriana came to him with the news that a white man was approaching through the forest, alone, and very sick. He closed the cartridge and loaded his gun with it, put those that were finished into his pocket, and set out in the direction indicated. The man was already clear of the bush when Mr. McMaster reached him, sitting on the ground, clearly in a bad way. He was without hat or boots, and his clothes were so torn that it was only by the dampness of his body that they adhered to it. His feet were cut and grossly swollen. Every exposed surface of skin was scarred by insect and bat bites. His eyes were wild with fever. He was talking to himself in delirium, but stopped when Mr. McMaster approached and addressed him in English. "I'm tired," the man said, and then, "Can't go any farther. My name is Henty, and I'm tired. Anderson died That was a long time ago. I expect you think I'm very odd.
I think you are ill, my friend.
Just tired. It must be several months since I had anything to eat.
Mr. McMaster hoisted him to his feet and, supporting him by the arm, led him across the hummocks of grass towards the farm. It is a very short way, and when we get there, I'll give you something to make you better.
Jolly kind of you.
And presently he said,
I say, you speak English. I'm English, too. My name is Henty.
Well, Mr. Henty, you want to bother about anything more? You're ill and you've had a rough journey. I'll take care of you. They went very slowly, but at length reached the house. Lie there in the hammock. I'll fetch something for you. Mr. McMaster went into the back room of the house and dragged a tin canister from under a heap of skins. It was full of a mixture of dried leaf and bark. He took a handful and went outside to the fire. When he returned, he put one hand behind Henty's head and held up the concoction of herbs in a calabash for him to drink. He sipped, shuddering slightly at the bitterness. At last he finished it. Mr. McMaster threw out the dregs on the floor, and Henty lay back in the hammock, sobbing quietly. Soon, he fell into a deep sleep. Ill-fated was the epithet applied by the press to the Anderson expedition to the Parima and upper Ururiquera region of Brazil. Every stage of the enterprise, from the preliminary arrangements in London to its tragic dissolution in Amazonas, was attacked by misfortune. It was due to one of the early setbacks that Paul Henty became connected with it. He was not by nature an explorer. An even-tempered, good-looking young man of fastidious tastes and enviable possessions, unintellectual but appreciative of fine architecture and the ballet, well-traveled in the more accessible parts of the world, a collector, though not a connoisseur, popular among hostesses, revered by his aunts. He was married to a lady of exceptional charm and beauty, and it was she who upset the good order of his life by confessing her affection for another man, for the second time in the 8 years of their marriage. The first occasion had been a short-lived infatuation with a tennis professional. The second was a captain in the Coldstream Guards, and more serious. Henty's first thought under the shock of this revelation was to go out and dine alone. He was a member of four clubs, but at three of them he was liable to meet his wife's lover. Accordingly, he chose one which he rarely frequented, a semi-intellectual company composed of publishers, barristers, and men of scholarship awaiting election to the Athenaeum. Here, after dinner, he fell into conversation with Professor Anderson and first heard of the proposed expedition to Brazil. The particular misfortune that was retarding arrangements at the moment was defalcation of the secretary with two-thirds of the expedition's capital. The principals were ready: Professor Anderson, Dr. Simmons, the anthropologist, Mr. Necker, the biologist, Mr. Broff, the surveyor, wireless operator, and mechanic. The scientific and sporting apparatus was packed up in crates, ready to be embarked. The necessary facilities had been stamped and signed by the proper authorities, but unless £1,200 was forthcoming, the whole thing would have to be abandoned. Henty, as had been suggested, was a man of comfortable means. The expedition would last from 9 months to a year. He could shut his country house. His wife, he reflected, would want to remain in London near her young man and cover more than the sum required. There was a glamour about the whole journey, which might, he felt, move even his wife's sympathies. There and then, over the club fire, he decided to accompany Professor Anderson. When he went home that evening, he announced to his wife, "I have decided what I shall do." "Yes, darling?" "You are certain that you no longer love me." "Darling, you know I adore you." "But you are certain you love this guardsman, Tony, whatever his name is, more?" "Oh, yes, ever so much more."
quite a different thing altogether. Very well, then. I do not propose to do anything about a divorce for a year. You shall have time to think it over. I am leaving next week for the Ura Requera.
Golly, where's that?
I'm not perfectly sure. Somewhere in Brazil, I think. It is unexplored. I shall be away a year.
But, darling, how ordinary. Like people in books. Big game, I mean, and all that.
You have obviously already discovered that I am a very ordinary person. Now, Paul, don't be disagreeable. Oh, there's the telephone. It's probably Tony. If it is, do you mind terribly if I talk to him alone for a bit? But in the 10 days of preparation that followed, she showed greater tenderness, putting off her soldier twice in order to accompany Henty to the shops where he was choosing his equipment and insisting on his purchasing a worsted cummerbund. On his last evening, she gave a supper party for him at the embassy, to which she allowed him to ask any of his friends he liked. He could think of no one except Professor Anderson, who looked oddly dressed, danced tirelessly, and was something of a failure with everyone. Next day, Mrs. Henty came with her husband to the boat train and presented him with a pale blue, extravagantly soft blanket in a suede case of the same color, furnished with a zip fastener and monogram. She kissed him goodbye and said, "Take care of yourself in wherever it is." Had she gone as far as Southampton, she might have witnessed two dramatic passages. Mr. Broff got no farther than the gangway before he was arrested for debt, a matter of £32. The publicity given to the dangers of the expedition was responsible for the action. Henty settled the account. The second difficulty was not to be overcome so easily. Mr. Necker's mother was on the ship before them. She carried a missionary journal in which she had just read an account of the Brazilian forests. Nothing would induce her to permit her son's departure. She would remain on board until he came ashore with her. If necessary, she would sail with him, but go into those forests alone, he should not. All argument was unavailing with the resolute old lady, who eventually, 5 minutes before the time of embarkation, bore her son off in triumph, leaving the company without a biologist. Nor was Mr. Broff's adherence long maintained. The ship in which they were traveling was a cruising liner taking passengers on a round voyage. Mr. Broff had not been on board a week and had scarcely accustomed himself to the motion of the ship before he was engaged to be married. He was still engaged, although to a different lady, when they reached Manaus, and refused all inducements to proceed further, borrowing his return fare from Henty, and arriving back in Southampton, engaged to the lady of his first choice, whom he immediately married. In Brazil, the officials to whom their credentials were addressed were all out of power. While Henty and Professor Anderson negotiated with the new administrators, Dr. Simmons proceeded upriver to Boa Vista, where he established a base camp with the greater part of the stores. These were instantly commandeered by the revolutionary garrison, and he himself imprisoned for some days and subjected to various humiliations, which so enraged him that when released, he made promptly for the coast, stopping at Manaus only long enough to inform his colleagues that he insisted on leaving his case personally before the central authorities at Rio. Thus, while they were still a month's journey from the start of their labors, Henty and Professor Anderson found themselves alone and deprived of the greater part of their supplies. The ignominy of immediate return was not to be borne. For a short time, they considered the advisability of going into hiding for 6 months in Madeira or Tenerife. But even there, detection seemed probable. There had been too many photographs in the illustrated papers before they left London. Accordingly, in low spirits, the two explorers at last set out alone for the Ura Requera, with little hope of accomplishing anything of any value to anyone. For 7 weeks, they paddled through green, humid tunnels of forest. They took a few snapshots of naked, misanthropic Indians, bottled some snakes, and later lost them when their canoe capsized in the rapids.
They overtaxed their digestions, imbibing nauseous intoxicants at native galas. They were robbed of the last of their sugar by a Guinness prospector. Finally, Professor Anderson fell ill with malignant malaria, chattered feebly for some days in his hammock, lapsed into a coma, and died, leaving Henty alone with a dozen Maku oarsmen, none of whom spoke a word of any language known to him. They reversed their course and drifted downstream with a minimum of provisions and no mutual confidence. One day, a week or so after Professor Anderson's death, Henty awoke to find that his boys and his canoe had disappeared during the night, leaving him with only his hammock and pajamas, some 200 or 300 miles from the nearest Brazilian habitation. Nature forbade him to remain where he was, although there seemed little purpose in moving. He set himself to follow the course of the stream, at first in the hope of meeting a canoe. But presently, the whole forest became peopled for him with frantic apparitions. For no conscious reason at all, he plodded on, now wading in the water, now scrambling through the bush. Vaguely, at the back of his mind, he'd always believed that the jungle was a place full of food, that there was danger of snakes and savages and wild beasts, but not of starvation. But now he observed that this was far from being the case. The jungle consisted solely of immense tree trunks embedded in a tangle of thorn and vine rope, all far from nutritious. On the first day, he suffered hideously. Later, he seemed anesthetized and was chiefly embarrassed by the behavior of the inhabitants who came out to meet him in footman's livery, carrying his dinner, and then irresponsibly disappeared or raised the cover of their dishes and revealed live tortoises. Many people who knew him in London appeared and ran around him with derisive cries, asking him questions to which he could not possibly know the answers. His wife came, too, and he was pleased to see her, assuming that she'd got tired of her guardsmen and was there to fetch him back. But soon, she disappeared, like all the others. It was then that he remembered that it was imperative for him to reach Manaus. He redoubled his energy, stumbling against boulders in the stream and getting caught up among the vines. But I mustn't waste my breath, he reflected. And then he forgot that, too, and was conscious of nothing more until he found himself lying in a hammock in Mr. McMaster's house. His recovery was slow. At first, days of lucidity alternated with delirium. Then his temperature dropped, and he was conscious even when most ill. The days of fever grew less frequent, finally occurring in the normal system of the tropics between long periods of comparative health. Mr. McMaster dosed him regularly with herbal remedies. "It's very nasty," said Henty, "but it does do good." "There's medicine for everything in the forest," said Mr. McMaster, "to make you well and to make you ill. My mother was an Indian, and she taught me many of them. I've learned others from time to time from my wives. There are plants to cure you and give you fever, to kill you and send you mad, to keep away snakes, to intoxicate fish so that you can pick them out of the water with your hands like fruit from a tree. There are medicines even I do not know. They said that it is possible to bring dead people back to life after they have begun to stink. But I have not seen it done." "But surely you're English."
"My father was, at least a Barbadian. He came to British Guiana as a missionary. He was married to a white woman, but he left her in Guiana to look for gold. Then he took my mother. The Shiriana women are ugly but very devoted. I have had many. Most of the men and women living in this savanna are my children. That is why they obey. For that reason and because I have a gun." "My father lived to a great age. It is not 20 years since he died. He was a man of education."
Can you read?
Yes, of course.
It is not everyone who is so fortunate. I cannot.
Henty laughed apologetically. But I suppose you haven't much opportunity here.
Oh, yes. That is just it. I have a great many books. I will show you when you are better. Until 5 years ago, there was an Englishman, at least a black man, but he was well-educated in Georgetown. He died. He used to read to me every day until he died. You shall read to me when you are better.
I shall be delighted to.
Yes. You shall read to me, Mr. McMaster repeated, nodding over the calabash.
During the early days of his convalescence, Henty had little conversation with his host. He lay in the hammock, staring up at the thatched roof and thinking about his wife, rehearsing over and over again different incidents in their life together, including her affairs with the tennis professional and the soldier. The days, exactly 12 hours each, passed without distinction. Mr. McMaster retired to sleep at sundown, leaving a little lamp burning, a hand-woven wick drooping from a pot of beef fat to keep away vampire bats. The first time that Henty left the house, Mr. McMaster took him for a stroll around the farm.
I will show you the black man's grave, he said, leading him to a mound between the mango trees. He was very kind to me. Every afternoon until he died, for 2 hours, he used to read to me. I think I will put up a cross to commemorate his death and your arrival. A pretty idea. Do you believe in God?
I've never really thought about it much.
Ah, you're perfectly right. I have thought about it a great deal, and I still do not know. Dickens did.
I suppose so.
Oh, yes. It is apparent in all his books, you'll see.
That afternoon, Mr. McMaster began the construction of a headpiece for the Negro's grave. He worked with a large spokeshave in a wood so hard that it grated and rang like metal. At last, when Henty had passed 6 or 7 consecutive days without fever, Mr. McMaster said, "Now, I think you are well enough to see the books." At one end of the hut, there was a kind of a loft, formed by a rough platform erected up in the eaves of the roof. Mr. McMaster propped the ladder against it and mounted. Henty followed, still unsteady after his illness. Mr. McMaster sat on the platform, and Henty stood at the top of the ladder looking over. There was a heap of small bundles there, tied up with rag, palm leaf, and raw hide.
It has been hard to keep up the worms and the ants. 2 are practically destroyed. But there is an oil the Indians know how to make that is useful.
He unwrapped the nearest parcel and handed down a calf-bound book. It was an early American edition of Bleak House.
It does not matter which we take first.
You're fond of Dickens?
Why, yes, of course. More than fond, far more. You see, they are the only books I have ever heard. My father used to read them, and then later the black man. And now you. I have heard them all several times by now, but I never get tired. There's always more to be learned and noticed. So many characters, so many changes of scene, so many words. I have all Dickens' books except those that the ants devoured. It takes a long time to read them all. More than 2 years.
Well, said Henty lightly, they will well last out my visit.
Oh, I hope not. It is delightful to start again. Each time, I think I find more to enjoy and admire.
They took down the first volume of Bleak House, and that afternoon, Henty had his first reading. He'd always rather enjoyed reading aloud, and in the first year of marriage had shared several books in this way with his wife. Until one day, in one of her rare moments of confidence, she remarked that it was torture to her. Sometimes, after that, he had thought it might be agreeable to have children to read to, but Mr. McMaster was a unique audience. The old man sat astride his hammock opposite Henty, fixing him throughout with his eyes and following the words soundlessly with his lips. Often, when a new character was introduced, he would say,
"Repeat the name, I've forgotten him." Or, "Oh, yes, yes, I remember her well. She dies, poor woman."
He would frequently interrupt with questions, not as Henty would have imagined, about the circumstances of the story, such things as the procedure of the Lord Chancellor's court or the social conventions of the time, though they must have been unintelligible, did not concern him, but always about the characters. Now, why does she say that? Does she really mean it? Did she feel faint because of the heat of the fire or something in that paper? He laughed loudly at the jokes and at some passages which did not seem humorous to Henty, asking him to repeat them two or three times. And later, at the description of the sufferings of the outcasts in Tom All Alone, tears ran down his cheeks into his beard. His comments on the story were usually simple. "I think that Dedlock is a very proud man." Or, "Mrs. Jellybee does not take care enough of her children." Henty enjoyed the readings almost as much as he did. At the end of the first day, the old man said, "You read beautifully, with a far better accent than the black man, and you explain better. It is almost as though my father were here again." And always at the end of the session, he thanked his guest courteously. "I enjoyed that very much. It was an extremely distressing chapter, but if I remember rightly, it will all turn out well." By the time that they were well into the second volume, however, the novelty of the old man's delight had begun to wane, and Henty was feeling strong enough to be restless. He touched more than once on the subject of his departure, asked about canoes and rains and the possibility of finding guides. But Mr. McMaster seemed obtuse and paid no attention to these hints. One day, running his thumb through the pages of Bleak House that remained to be read, Henty said, "We still have a lot to get through. I hope I shall be able to finish it before I go." "Oh, yes," said Mr. McMaster. "Do not disturb yourself about that. You'll have time to finish it, my friend." For the first time, Henty noticed something slightly menacing in his host's manner. That evening at supper, a brief meal of farine and dried beef eaten just before sundown, Henty renewed the subject. "You know, Mr. McMaster, the time has come when I must be thinking about getting back to civilization. I've already imposed myself on your hospitality for too long." Mr. McMaster bent over his plate, crunching mouthfuls of farine, but made no reply. "How soon do you think I shall be able to get a boat?" "I said, how soon do you think I shall be able to get a boat?" "I appreciate all your kindness to me more than I can say, but..." "My friend, any kindness I may have shown you is amply repaid by your reading of Dickens. Do not let us mention the subject again." "Well, I'm very glad you've enjoyed it. I have too, but I really must be thinking of getting back." "Yes," said Mr. McMaster. "The black man was like that. He thought of it all the time, but he died here." Twice during the next day, Henty opened the subject, but his host was evasive, and finally he said, "Forgive me, Mr. McMaster, but I really must press the point. When can I get a boat?" "There is no boat." "Well, the Indians can build one." "You must wait for the rains. There's not enough water in the river now." "How long will that be?" "A month, 2 months." They had finished Bleak House and were nearing the end of Dombey and Son when the rain came. "Now, it's time to make preparations to go." "Oh, that is impossible. The Indians will not make a boat during the rainy season. It is one of their superstitions." "You might have told me." "Did I not mention it? I forgot." Next morning, Henty went out alone while his host was busy, and looking as aimless as he could, he strolled across the savannah to the group of Indian houses. There were four or five Shirianas sitting in one of the doorways. They did not look up as he approached them. He addressed them in the few words of Maku he had acquired during the journey, but they made no sign whether they understood him or not. Then he drew a sketch of a canoe in the sand. He went through some vague motions of carpentry, pointing from them to him, then made motions of giving something to them and scratched out the outlines of a gun and hat and a few other recognizable articles of trade.
One of the women giggled, but no one gave any sign of comprehension, and he went away unsatisfied. At their midday meal, Mr. McMaster said, "Mr. Henty, the Indians tell me you've been trying to speak with them. It is easier that you say anything you wish through me. You realize, do you not, that they would do nothing without my authority? They regard themselves, quite rightly in most cases, as my children." Well, as a matter of fact, I was asking them about a canoe. So they gave me to understand. And now, if you have finished your meal, perhaps we might have another chapter. I am quite absorbed in the book. They finished Dombey and Son. Nearly a year had passed since Henty had left England, and his gloomy foreboding of permanent exile became subtly acute when between the pages of Martin Chuzzlewit he found a document written in pencil in irregular characters. Year 1919. I, James McMaster of Brazil, do swear to Barnabas Washington of Georgetown that if he finish this book, in fact Martin Chuzzlewit, I will let him go away back as soon as finished. There followed a heavy pencil X, and after it, Mr. McMaster made this mark, signed Barnabas Washington. "Mr. McMaster," said Henty, "I must speak frankly. You saved my life. And when I get back to civilization, I will reward you to the best of my ability. I will give you anything within reason. But at present, you are keeping me here against my will. I demand to be released."
"But my friend, what is keeping you? You are under no restraint. Go when you like."
"You know very well that I can't get away without your help."
"In that case, you must humor an old man. Read me another chapter."
"Mr. McMaster, I swear by anything you like that when I get to Manaus, I will find someone to take my place. I will pay a man to read to you all day."
"But I have no need of another man. You read so well."
"I have read for the last time."
"I hope not," said Mr. McMaster politely.
That evening at supper, only one piece of dried meat and farine was brought, and Mr. McMaster ate alone. Henty lay without speaking, staring at the thatch. Next day at noon, a single plate was put before Mr. McMaster, but with it lay his gun, cocked on his knee as he ate. Henty resumed the reading of Martin Chuzzlewit, where it had been interrupted. Weeks passed hopelessly. They read Nicholas Nickleby and Little Dorrit and Oliver Twist. Then a stranger arrived in the Savannah, a half-caste prospector, one of that lonely order of men who wander for a lifetime through the forests, tracing the little streams, sifting the gravel, and ounce by ounce, filling the little leather sack of gold dust, more often than not dying of exposure and starvation with $500 worth of gold hung around their necks. Mr. McMaster was vexed at his arrival, gave him farine and paso, and sent him on his journey within an hour of his arrival. But in that hour, Henty had the time to scribble his name on a piece of paper and put it into the man's hand. From now on, there was hope. The days followed their unvarying routine. Coffee at sunrise, a morning of inaction while Mr. McMaster pottered about on the business of the farm, farine and paso at noon, Dickens in the afternoon, farine and paso and sometimes some fruit for supper, silence from sunset to dawn with a small wick glowing in the beef fat and the palm thatch overhead dimly discernible. But Henty lived in quiet confidence and expectation. Sometime this year or the next, the prospector will arrive at a Brazilian village with news of his discovery. The disasters to the Anderson expedition would not have passed unnoticed. Henty could imagine the headlines that must have appeared in the popular press. Even now, probably, there were search parties working over the country he had crossed. Any day, English voices might sound over the savannah, and a dozen friendly adventurers come crashing through the bush. Even as he was reading, while his lips mechanically followed the printed pages, his mind wandered away from his eager, crazy host opposite, and he began to narrate to himself incidents of his homecoming. The gradual re-encounters with civilization. He shaved and bought new clothes at Manaus, telegraphed for money, received wires of congratulations. He enjoyed the leisurely river journey to Belém, the big liner to Europe, savored good claret and fresh meat and spring vegetables. He was shy at meeting his wife and uncertain how to address her.
"Darling, you've been much longer than you said. I quite thought you were lost."
And then Mr. McMaster interrupted. "May I trouble you to read that passage again? It is one I particularly enjoy." The weeks passed. There was no sign of rescue. But Henty endured the day for hope of what might happen on the morrow. He even felt a slight stirring of cordiality towards his jailer and was therefore quite willing to join him when one evening, after a long conference with an Indian neighbor, he proposed a celebration. "It is one of the local feast days," he explained, "and they have been making piwari. You may not like it, but you should try some. We will go across to the man's home tonight." Accordingly, after supper, they joined a party of Indians that were assembled around the fire in one of the huts at the other side of the savannah. They were singing in an apathetic, monotonous manner and passing a large calabash of liquid from mouth to mouth. Separate bowls were brought for Henty and Mr. McMaster, and they were given hammocks to sit in. "You must drink it without lowering the cup. That is the etiquette." Henty gulped the dark liquid, trying not to taste it, but it was not unpleasant. Hard and muddy on the palate, like most of the beverage he'd been offered in Brazil, but with a flavor of honey and brown bread. He leaned back in the hammock, feeling unusually contented. Perhaps at that very moment, the search party was in camp a few hours' journey from them. Meanwhile, he was warm and drowsy. The cadence of song rose and fell interminably, liturgically. Another calabash of piwari was offered him, and he handed it back empty. He lay full length, watching the play of shadows on the thatch as the Shirianas began to dance. And then he shut his eyes and thought of England and his wife and fell asleep. He awoke, still in the Indian hut, but with the impression that he had outslept his usual hour. By the position of the sun, he knew it was late afternoon. No one else was about. He looked for his watch and found, to his surprise, that it was not on his wrist. He had left it in the house, he supposed, before coming to the party. "I must have been tight last night," he reflected. "Treacherous drink, that." He had a headache and feared a recurrence of fever. He found, when he set his feet to the ground, that he stood with difficulty. His walk was unsteady, and his mind confused, as it had been during the first weeks of his convalescence. On the way across the savannah, he was obliged to stop more than once, shutting his eyes and breathing deeply. When he reached the house, he found Mr. McMaster sitting there. "Ah, my friend, you are late for the reading this afternoon. There's scarcely another half hour of light. How do you feel?"
"Rotten. That drink doesn't seem to agree with me."
"I will give you something to make you better. The forest has remedies for everything, to make you awake and to make you sleep."
"You haven't seen my watch anywhere."
"You've missed it?"
"Yes. I thought I was wearing it. I've never slept so long."
"Not since you were a baby. Do you know how long?"
"2 days." "Nonsense. I can't have."
"Yes, indeed. It is a long time.
It is a pity, because you missed our guests." "Guests?"
"Why, yes. I have been quite gay while you were asleep. 3 men from outside, Englishmen. It is a pity you missed them. A pity for them, too, as they particularly wished to see you. But what could I do? You were so sound asleep. They had come all the way to find you. So I thought you would not mind, as you could not greet them yourself. I gave them a little souvenir. Your watch. They wanted something to take home to your wife, who was offering a great reward for news of you.
They were very pleased with it, and they took some photographs of the little cross I put up to commemorate your coming. They were pleased with that, too. They were very easily pleased. But I do not suppose they will visit us again. Our life here is so retired. No pleasures except reading. I do not suppose we shall ever have visitors again. Well, I will get you some medicine to make you feel better. Your head aches, does it not? We will not have any Dickens today, but tomorrow, and the day after that, and the day after that, let us read Little Dorrit again. There are passages in that book I can never hear without the temptation to weep.
Leonard Nimoy read Evelyn Waugh's tale, The Man Who Liked Dickens. We spoke with Leonard backstage at the J. Paul Getty Museum.
It's a delicious opportunity to perform in a precise, special way. The material, particularly when the stories are good ones, offer an opportunity for a comedy, drama, suspense, in a kind of a gem-like, confined space. I think of them as miniatures, miniature dramas. What they have in common is this sort of jewel in a contained space and time of a drama or a comedy, whatever it may be, beginning, middle, end, narrative, sure. The culture, to me, is irrelevant. I find that as an actor, you approach the piece in the same way. What is the story and how shall I tell it? Particularly for me, what I enjoy a lot is the fact that doing the short stories, there are often multiple characters to play. For me, it's fun and I think important to find a way to vocalize and identify vocally each of those characters separately so the audience can have the pleasure of knowing which character you're doing at any given moment and avoid the confusion, but also to enjoy recognizing this person and visualizing this person all through the vocal characterization you give the person. One of the wonderful things, particularly for me, that I enjoy about it is the convenience of it. We are usually at the mercy of production requirements to do what we do. Someone has to choose a play or a screenplay. Someone has to raise a sizable amount of money. Someone has to arrange all the logistics of bringing together a company to a theater or to a location, a camera crew or whatever is necessary, before you can begin to even rehearse and perform. And this form, reading short stories, is such a kind of a reduction to essentials that it's possible to do it and get a great deal of joy doing it without having to go through all the, without having to wait for all of those other things to fall into place. For those of us who are control freaks, you have the whole thing in the palm of your hand, including the audience, hopefully. It's all there for you. You tell the story from beginning to middle to end as a straight-through narrative. It literally is storytelling. You tell the story, the whole story. And in that sense, there's a tremendous amount of pleasure.